Hello and welcome. Especially welcome for braving the weather. You are hearty souls. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I'm the curator for most of these events, the event series we have at the library. We have a colloquia series, a film series, and a writer's series. And we have these events to showcase and highlight materials, collections, and services of the library. That Jim Daniels is here actually showcases several collections. Jim gave his papers to the library right around 2000, I think. And in special collections, there is the Jim Daniels collection, which is part of the Michigan Writers Collection, which features a number of other authors, including Richard Ford. So their papers, their manuscripts. Jim just brought two more boxes today of stuff. This particular event also is a film event. So right down the hallway is the Digital Multimedia Center. Now has well over 5,000 feature films. They're all for, people say, rent. No, we loan materials. We don't rent them. 7-day loans, findable in the catalog. And just the general collections, especially when I think of Jim, he's a poet and an author. We have a world-class collection for studies in American literature. John Beck will introduce Jim. John Beck comes from the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations, and who curates our co-sponsor. Thank you. He curates the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives series in coordination with MSU Museum and the College of Social Science. So please welcome John, and he'll talk about Jim.
Well, I've handed out a few flyers for our brown bag series. We actually have a brown bag tomorrow, and I invite you all to come hear Mindy Morgan talk about versions of American Indian life that were part of a periodical called Indians at Work. And so please do come out for that and other things that are coming up on under our series. You know, I've been lucky because of the fact that I first met Jim Daniels in 1981. So it's been 30 years that Jim and I have been friends. And his amount of work is actually just stunning in terms of how it's changed over time and everything else. Arguably, Jim is, I would say, one of the most respected voices in contemporary poetry and fiction generally, and in the poetry and fiction of labor and working people specifically. He's written of the life of himself and others on the automotive shop floor, as well as capturing the absurdities of life as a tenured professor. He has persona poems that are known as the Digger poems about the automotive shop floor, and the Tenured Guy poems written once Jim became a tenured professor. His poem on the 1967 riots in Detroit, Time Temperature, is, I would say, and I'm not the only one, arguably one of the finest poems reflecting on race and or the Motor City ever written. Jim's a prize-winning poet. He's a prize-winning fiction writer. He's the author of four books of short fiction, three of which have been published by Michigan State University Press, which is also a co-sponsor of tonight. And there are books for sale in back. Julie Lohr from the press is here, as is Gabe Dotto, who's the director of the MSU Press and has done an unbelievable job piloting the press over the last few years and doing just some wonderful things. Anyway, the press put out three books of Jim's fiction. The first one was actually published, No Pets, was published by Bottom Dog Press out of Ohio, which is another just actually stunning press of both poetry, fiction, and nonfiction and other things. But the short film he'll be showing later tonight, Mr. Pleasant, is from his third book and is actually his third film. I think Jim can tell us more about the films. And is adapted from the title story of the second collection from the press, Mr. Pleasant. His newest collection, Trigger Man, More Tales from the Motor City, is available in back tonight. And it was just published by the MSU Press in 2011. Jim has published over, here comes the figure, over 20 books of and chapbooks of poetry in his life as a poet. His most recent include From Milltown to Malltown, published in 2010, and two collections, Having a Little Talk with Capital P Poetry, and this is fresh off the press, literally fresh off the press, All of the Above that arrived in my mailbox late in 2011. Jim's poetry and fiction both, what I like about them, and I think if you're a Daniels fan, or after tonight you'll be a Daniels fan, the wonderful thing is Jim has an unbelievably accessible poetry and unbelievably accessible fiction that respects the people and the things that he writes about. And you don't always see that in poetry. Poetry often takes a sarcastic tone. And I'm really going to say that it's not that Jim's poetry by any stretch is light or anything else. In fact, I would say that Jim's poetry can be gritty and really just tells it like it is. But his poetry is respectful of those shop floor workers, of those other folks who inhabit the work that he has captured for all of us on paper and in multiple publications, as I've said. So welcome back to Michigan with me, Jim Daniels.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming out. I really feel like Michigan State is my literary home here, not only because the library was kind enough to take all my junk, and the fact that Michigan State has been kind enough to publish and support my work over these, particularly with this most recent book, for these last three books of stories, and also because I really gave my first poetry reading to any kind of an audience at the Kellogg Center where I'm spending the night, when they used to have these Michigan poetry festivals, and as part of the festivals they had, I think it was called Young Voices of Michigan Poetry, and you submitted your work, and if you got chosen, you got to come and read in front of an actual audience. So that was, for me, a coming out of sorts. So tonight I'd like to read you a short story and then show you a short film. I'd like to emphasize that both are short, so that I'm not going to keep you here all night. The story I'd like to read, excuse me for a second, it's called Candy Necklace. And it was inspired by the cover of another book by an outstanding writer from Michigan, Jean Leiby, who unfortunately died in a car accident just last year. She was, at that time, the editor of the Southern Review. But she wrote a book of short stories called Downriver, and I recommend it highly. But the cover of that book was a young, kind of adolescent girl with a candy necklace around her neck, and it took me back to a particular time and place that I try to reflect in the story. Candy necklace. Shelley bit another hard, tasteless bead off of her candy necklace, a yellow one. It tasted just like a green or red one. The flimsy elastic holding it together stretched across her mouth. Then she bit off a red one, pink really, and pulled the necklace back down over her neck, sticky where the other beads had gotten wet with spit. Her mother, Ginger, sat next to her on the orange plastic waiting room bench in the emergency room at Mercy. Shelley pressed a huge bloody mess of towels against Ginger's arm as they waited to be called. So much blood dripping onto the floor, Shelley thought maybe they'd have to cut the damn arm off, and then her mother could never hit her again, at least with her strong arm. Candy had to look like itself to taste good, Shelley thought, like candy bars. They were just bars. That was a perfect shape for chocolate, a rectangle you could wrap a hand around, bite into. Candy that was supposed to look like something else always tasted bad. Candy cigarettes, wax lips, licorice shoelaces, Swedish fish, What made them Swedish? Did they swim with an accent? Sweden, what does she know about Sweden? Her brother Randy said they made porn there. He was 17 and imagined pornography in his sleep. Shelley called him Porno Boy until their mother slapped her across the face. Randy had left home. No one had heard from Porno Boy in 6 months. Ginger told the school he dropped out, though he'd made no such official declaration on his way out the door. He'd stolen at least one car, apparently, so there was some interest in his whereabouts on the part of the authorities. Shelley's father, Stoney, was mad because in his line of work, any attention from the authorities was not good for business. Stoney was a truck driver who delivered product. Ginger, Jin, her friends called her, though Shelley didn't know how many people fessed up to being her friend these days, had an accident with a half-gallon bottle of whiskey. Ginger had let her drive to the hospital, though she was only 14. Her mother stretched across the seat and operated the pedals, groaning through Shelley's wide turns. Gin Ginny, she wears a white dress. Gin Ginny, her hand is a mess. Shelley had never been in an emergency room before, though even she found that hard to believe. How come we're just sitting here? They should have a long sink for everybody to bleed into while they wait. Shelley chomped down hard and bit a few more beads off her necklace. She was a smart-ass 14, which meant she was 16 in certain states. She thought this might be an occasion to pull out her harmonica and wail some blues, but she thought wrong. Ginger couldn't hit her without taking pressure off her wound and risking another blood spurt, but she growled at Shelley so viciously that Shelley just blew one loud, defiant note and put the harmonica back in the breast pocket of her shirt. The breast pocket. Her breasts were a sore spot. Two sore spots. Sore, and that was supposed to be a good sign. Something happened in there that had already happened to 10 or more of her best and worst friends, and it was time it happened to her. Don't you think it's time you stop eating candy, Ginger said. Since when is there an age limit on candy, Shelley said. Her mother hesitated. It looked like she was going to say something, but then lost whatever it was in the fog of pain, or maybe she was just still drunk. You look like you're going to pass out, Shelley said evenly. She'd witnessed her mother pass out on numerous occasions, though never from loss of blood or shock or whatever she was experiencing at the moment that made her pale face wobble and sweat. What's it take to get attention around here? My mom's bleeding to death. What's it take to get some stitches? She shouted that last part at the fat, slouched nurse whose uniform buttons were pulling apart to reveal a lime green bra beneath the white polyester. Shelley would never wear a lime green bra. She knew that much. Odd, lumpy vegetables. The green showed right through the uniform like the nurse was some superhero with her costume on underneath. If only, Shelley thought. Then her mother slumped in her seat and tumbled over, her head hitting the tile floor with a disconcerting clunk. At home, they had wall-to-wall carpeting, her mother's drunken falls cushioned into incidental pauses in the angry static electricity of their daily lives. Lives in which Stoney made infrequent cameo appearances to either drop off some cash or hawk some easily movable item, depending on the state of the nation. I saw a woman with two bras on today, her sister Tina said matter-of-factly. Tina could report on a gruesome car accident or the details of her bowel movements with the same voice, a reporter's voice, distant and authoritative. Tina was 16, and Shelley needed her to do more than report. Shelley worried that Tina was becoming an alien or at least part of some other family. She didn't seem affected by the cliched but intense drama of their daily lives. Alcoholic mother, absent brother, absent father. Stoney was AWOL again, supposedly on a run to Florida to pick up some product. Tina and Shelley knew better than to ask about product. They took the cash when it was available and shut up about it. Stoney was a truck driver. That much was true, and they held on to that much. Two bras, huh? Ginger said with a mouthful of tough chicken wedged into her cheek. Maybe I should try that for a new look. Maybe I'll get bigger tips, one for the price of two. Shelley laughed. Tina laughed. Ginger laughed. But none of them were on the same page of laughter. None of them were in the same book. The dinner table had gotten stranger and stranger since Randy's disappearance and Stoney's extended wanderings. Most of the time, Tina seemed to be putting her mother on. Gina was often so drunk she didn't pick up on it, or if she did, overreacted, overturning the table, lunging at Tina. It wasn't doing much for Shelley's appetite. For a while, she tried to put on weight, thinking that would help her figure develop, but she was thin and getting thinner. She was on a candy diet, lots of chocolate, chocolate and cigarettes. She stole the candy from the drugstore at the corner, then bought her cigarettes there when she had the money. The clerks worked behind thick glass, and they weren't about to come out and try to bust someone for shoplifting candy. They put the cigarettes on a little bulletproof carousel, and Shelley put her money on it and twirled it around, and no one asked how old she was or why that candy bar was sticking out of her pocket. It was all part of the math of their gritty neighborhood, the old math, where you carried the one, and anything in parentheses was not big enough to be part of the equation. Two bras, one for each boob, Shelley asked. Her mother laughed so hard, she sprayed pieces of chicken across the table. Tina didn't laugh. She should have at least smiled, but she didn't. No, one on top of the other. One was red and the other black. Ginger said. Nice combo. I like it. She took a swig of wine from her jelly glass to regain her equilibrium or to lose it again. Shelley wanted to ask why someone would do that, but she didn't want to risk sounding like a child. She was standing in that tiny A1 used car office, Tina said. The blinds were open. She didn't have a shirt on, just two bras. A man was sitting at his desk watching her. Then what happened? Shelley asked. I don't know. I guess she was putting a down payment on one of those junky cars in the lot. The light changed and I walked home, Tina said. The chicken was from the Colonel. Ginger worked part-time at the Colonel's, a place where she did not get tipped. Shelley felt vaguely ill. The two empty chairs at the table were beginning to mess with her equilibrium. Mom, are you and Dad still married? Shelley asked. Who told you that? What? That your father and I are divorced. Shelley gave Tina a look. Tina shook her head angrily. Somebody at school, Shelley mumbled. Ginger took a long swallow, then poured herself another glass from the industrial-sized bottle she kept on the floor beside her chair like a cherished pet. She was taking too long to answer, so whatever she said, Shelley knew it'd be a lie. Ginger was not a good liar, though Shelley wished that she were just a little better at it. Sometimes she needed to believe a lie or two to get through a bad day. People shouldn't be spreading rumors like that, Ginger said. Your father and I... She closed her eyes for a long time. Shelley thought she might be on the verge of passing out, though it was too early in the day for that. She opened her eyes again, finally. We don't have what you'd call a traditional marriage. No shit, Shelley said and instinctively ducked. Ginger just closed her eyes again, and this time her face fell to the side and into the open carton of mashed potatoes. This is happening way too often, Shelley said. It's becoming an unfortunate talent, Tina said. A parlor trick, but we don't have a parlor. Pick her head up out of those potatoes, will you? They looked at each other again, eye to eye. My sources don't lie, Tina said. Shelley picked up her mother's head and rested it on one of those cheap Colonel napkins. Pass me the chicken, Tina said. Shelley passed the bucket over. After Ginger got her attention by clunking her head on the floor, the big nurse finally took her back behind one of the curtained examination areas. Shelley stepped outside and lit up a cigarette near a couple of young smokers in scrubs. Hey, one of them said to her, aren't you a little young for that? Nah, this is a tough one, the other guy said. Just look at her. Shelley blinked through her thick mascara. Fuck you guys. Whoa, and she's got a mouth on her, too. What are you doing here? One of your friends OD? Or try to give herself an abortion? Come on, Gil, lighten up, the other guy said. She's just a kid. Shelley pulled down her tight top to cover her exposed belly. You guys aren't even doctors, she said. The guy named Gil put out a cigarette and shook his head. Kids aren't supposed to smoke. Stunts your growth. He stepped through the automatic doors and back into the hospital. The other guy stayed. We're nurses, actually, he said. My mother's getting stitches, actually, Shelley said. Cold outside, and she hadn't worn a jacket. Tina wasn't answering her phone. Shelley had school in the morning, and she didn't want to have to explain yet another missed day. Too bad. Is your dad in there with her? Shelley laughed. My father's out on the road with a truck full of product. The guy didn't say anything. He was squat and muscular, like someone who had wrestled in high school but was too short for football. His small movements on a concrete apron of the ER were graceful and fluid, confident. He had a tattoo on one forearm. Shelley couldn't tell what it was. She adds closer to him. "I drove her here," she said proudly. "I'm hoping my sister shows up to drive us home." "Your sister's old enough to drive?" "Yeah," she said, "but she don't have a car. The car's here." "Hey, what's your tattoo?" "Can't you tell?" he said. "It's Jesus and Gandhi. They're giving each other high fives." Shelley had been hoping the figures were in some band together, some hip band she didn't know about. She took a step back away from him. "I better check on her," she said. "If you need help, have them page me," he said. "I'm Mike Torres." He extended his hand. "Shelley," she said, and took his hand awkwardly. She rarely shook hands with anyone. She rarely touched anyone. Her cigarette had gone out. She quickly slipped it back into the pack and headed inside. She was shivering. "I don't understand why you don't have boobs yet," Tina said. "You've got your period going and everything. Things should be changing." "I think they're changing," Shelley said. "They were getting dressed for school." "What are we going to do without Dad?" she asked. "What we've been doing all along. How much is he ever here? And even when he is here, how much is he here?" "I wish Mom were a little more here too," Shelley said. "You can wish on that all you want," Tina said. She had a couple hickeys on her neck, Shelley noticed. She turned her back to Tina to put on her training bra. It was training nothing but air, but she'd insisted on getting a couple of bras just to be ready. Maybe if she put them both on at once. She laughed to herself and quickly pulled one of Tina's old T-shirts over her head. It was too small for her, but she liked things tight against her skin. Nothing loose, nothing that could get caught, snagged. "It's just me and you, sis," Tina continued. "Does that mean we're fucked then?" Shelley said. Shoplifting and cigarettes, cigarettes and swearing. Tina had been teaching her the fine points. "Not necessarily," Tina said, "but probably." Shelley wanted to hug Tina, but they didn't hug in their family. She wanted to embrace something solid. She wanted to hold on to the safety bar of the roller coaster and scream and scream. But Tina was out the door, so Shelley hurried behind her. Tina had a boy driving her to school some days, and some days he gave Shelley a ride, too. Ginger worked part-time at two different restaurants. She had no benefits. Stoney's work did not come with any benefits written down anywhere. They were bogged down in antiseptic limbo. The ER had to take them, though the paperwork was immense. They wouldn't let Ginger go until she filled out a stack of forms about income and being uninsured. Shelley sat with her mother in a tiny cubicle as a man explained the forms and showed her where to sign. Ginger was groggy and simply signed by the X's. Shelley took their copies of the documents and looked them over quickly. She felt a flash of time spinning its wheels, doing donuts in a parking lot until it was facing the other direction, and suddenly she was her mother's mother. It was almost tangible, a red buzz in her face. No way would they ever be able to dig themselves out of whatever debt they'd just committed to, Stony or no Stony. She shoved the papers into her purse. "What can they do to us, eh?" Ginger laughed in an odd, forced way that led to a coughing fit. The man behind the desk said nothing. "Can we leave now, or are you going to lock me up?" Ginger asked. "This is a hospital," the man said. "We don't lock anyone up." Ginger's arm was wrapped in gauze and tape. Shelley didn't want to look at what was under there. She knew Ginger wouldn't be able to work for a while. On their way out, a doctor intercepted them, putting his hand up in front of Ginger in a preemptive gesture as if to fend off a drunken tirade. "Remember, you can't drive," the doctor said. Then turning to Shelley, "She can't drive." We'll call a cab," Shelley said. "Now you remember, Mrs. Reed, what we talked about," the doctor said. "You've got this lovely young woman to take care of." Ginger lowered her head. Shelley blushed with shame. The doctor turned quickly away from them. They walked through the waiting room filled with the hurt and the scared and the angry. "What did you and that doctor talk about?" Shelley asked. "The weather? Sports? Politics?" "Shut up," Ginger said. She sounded both defeated and smoldering with rage. "How the hell are we going to pay for a cab? I thought I'd drive home since I did such a good job getting us here." I can drive one-handed better than you, Ginger said. Mom, your voice sounds like it's dipped in syrup or something. You sound worse than usual, Shelley sighed. I think they have a service we can use, she said vaguely. She rushed past to the receptionist before her mother could respond. Please page Mike Torres, she said. She looked over at her mother, who had fallen back into one of the plastic chairs. Only doctors and nurses can ask for pages, the woman said. It's an emergency. This is an emergency room, right? He's a nurse. Just call and reverse the charges. Shelley felt a surge of power, like she was holding the remote for the TV and would never let go. Is that your mother over there? The woman asked. Shelley waved to her mother, and her mother struggled to give her the finger with her undamaged hand. Did you ever think about what the hell Mom and Dad were doing when they had Randy, you, and me, boom, 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 Shelley asked. I know one thing they weren't doing, and that's using birth control. Tina had become sexually active and had the pills to prove it, along with a purse full of colorful condoms that she seemed to spill onto the floor more frequently than necessary. Why did they want three kids? Why did they want to bring us into this? This, she repeated, gesturing around the tiny kitchen littered with cigarette butts and empty bottles and dirty glasses, a room in which she could nearly touch all four walls from where she stood. Noon on a Saturday, and she and Tina were cleaning up from another one of their mother's small gatherings of like-minded individuals from the night before. Ginger was in the shower doing her old cleanup. Shelley had made earplugs from toilet paper and had wedged Tina's pillow against her head, but she still did not sleep until everyone had left. Tina had disappeared out the window for most of the night. Shelley had no idea when she'd return to reclaim her pillow. They must have been in love, Tina said, or stoned out of their minds, which I think is kind of like the same thing. You might have been stoned before, Shelley said, but you never been in love. You got all those balloons in your purse, but you don't love Eddie, do you? When you get boobs, you come back and talk to me, Tina said. Come back? From where? We share a bed, remember? They must have had health insurance back then. I hear that having a baby costs a mint these days, Tina said. Shelley found a rolled-up dollar bill on the floor, smoothed it out, folded it in half, and slipped it into her pocket. Don't let any drug-sniffing dogs get near that dollar, Tina said. Shelley shrugged. She wiped her hands on her jeans. It'd be nice to have health insurance, Shelley said. Maybe health insurance and a dog. Health insurance, a dog, and a backyard where we could grow sunflowers and a vacation at the beach. You're losing it, sister, Tina said. All of us, the five of us in bathing suits, laying in beach chairs and sunglasses under a big umbrella, and we have cold drinks. Cold drinks, Tina said. That's part of the problem here, don't you think? Mike Torres appeared embarrassed when he saw Shelley sitting with her mother. He glanced at the receptionist and gave her an exaggerated sigh. Hey, girl, he said to Shelley, I assume this is your lovely mother. Ginger gave him a foul look but said nothing. Her eyes drifted shut. What can I do for you? He asked. He seemed a little irked, but Shelley did not care. She had the papers in her purse. She had the keys in her pocket. We need a ride, she said. My sister didn't show. We don't have cab money. She smiled and tilted her head in what she thought might be a flirtatious way. She imagined it was what Tina might do. Mike sighed. Shit. Come on, Mike Torres, Shelley said. Be a man. He raised an eyebrow at her. How far you live? Not too far, Shelley said. She stretched back so that her shirt pulled up above her navel. Give me 15 minutes, he said, and hurried off. He was true to his word, for a short while later he appeared with a stained brown leather jacket over his scrubs. I'll get my car, he said. Meet me outside with the old lady. Ginger was asleep, and Shelley roused her. Come on, Mom, you don't need crutches. You hurt your hand, remember? Mike's car smelled like pot and aftershave. It was spotless. A silver cross hung from the rearview mirror along with some colored beads. When Shelley saw them, she reached up to her neck. She was still wearing the candy necklace. She quickly yanked it over her head and stuffed it into her purse, a large black cloth bag that Tina called her bag of tricks. She often rested a hand inside it like it was a sling. Shelley sat in the front with Mike while Ginger slumped down in the back, and they drove off from Mercy and into the city. Shelley squirmed in the silence. She pulled her harmonica out of her purse and started playing the theme from the Flintstones. She'd had two lessons from a friend of Stoney's who played in a blues band in town and, like many musicians, seemed enamored of the product. She knew Happy Birthday and Pop Goes the Weasel. Her goal was to be able to play Whammer Jammer, but she hadn't gotten past Wham. "You're just full of surprises," Mike said. "You know any songs about Jesus?" "Yeah, I know Yabba Dabba Jesus. Listen." She continued playing the Flintstones theme song. "From town, bedrock," Ginger mumbled groggily from the back seat. "So what's the deal with her?" Mike asked under his breath. Shelley turned around and looked at Ginger. Her eyes were closed again, delirious and bedrock. Shelley turned back to Mike. She realized that saying aloud would make it true, but she knew it was more true than anything. "She's an alcoholic, for starters," she said. "So your dad's got a paper out on Mars and your mom's a drunk. What's for finishers?" he asked. "He delivers product," Shelley repeated. "They're getting divorced," she added, since apparently that was true too. Ginger groaned from the back seat. "And the sister of yours?" he asked. "She's good," Shelley said, though she wasn't sure. She broke the elastic from the candy necklace with her sharp fingernails and then popped a few loose beads into her mouth. "Turn here," Shelley said. "And this is your street?" he said. Shelley hadn't thought much about where they lived. It was just home. They had a tiny two-bedroom house Stoney had paid cash for at a time when their lives resembled the normal lives Shelley saw on TV, except that no one ever paid cash for a house. The street was littered with empty lots where houses had once stood, where no one would ever build again. To Shelley, the weedy lots were just part of the landscape, like someone who lost teeth through no fault of their own. "You're getting me down, Mike Torres," she said. "This is the house, right here." "I'm just saying, look, I forgot your name. I'm just saying, this is no picnic grove you're living in." It hit her hard that he had not remembered her name. She put her hand on the door handle. "Shelley," she said. "My name is Shelley. You don't need to tell me about where I live." She had not cried in years, but she felt like she was going to. The car stopped, and she yanked up on the handle and jumped out, then reached into the back seat to help her mother. Behind her, Mike Torres gently touched her shoulder. "Let me get her. I do this for a living." He lifted Ginger up, and she roused her head. "Who the fuck are you?" she asked. "Mike Torres," he said. "I'm a nurse who's helping you get back home." He opened his coat to reveal his blue scrubs. Shelley envied the clarity of that statement. She wanted to say, "I am Shelley Reed. I'm someone who's doing something." Even if it was a lie, even if it was only true for a few seconds. Ginger seemed to accept Mike, taking his hand as he guided her to the door and inside while Shelley led the way, unlocking the door with her mother's key and holding it open for them. Inside, the broken bottle and the trail of blood and the smell of whiskey hit her all at once. It made Shelley want to vomit, but she swallowed hard and quickly led Mike to Ginger's bedroom, where he eased her onto the unmade bed. "Thank you, young man," Ginger said. She turned her head to the wall and closed her eyes again. Shelley heard laughter coming from the room she shared with Tina. She slipped across the hall and cracked the door open. Tina was in their bed with Eddie, the guy who drove to school. Tina looked up. "What the fuck, Shelley? Is Mom okay?" "You got the message?" Shelley said. "Why didn't you come?" Tina looked at Eddie. He laughed. Shelley slammed the door on them. Mike stood at the door, jangling his keys. "Gotta run, girl," he said. She looked at him. "Shelley," he said, and smiled. Shelley suddenly pushed herself forward and into his arms, wrapping them around the leather jacket, squeezing hard as he tried to pull away, squeezing until he gave in and hugged her back. "Don't go," she mumbled into the soft leather of his jacket. "You gotta let me go," he said. "I'm sorry." "Kiss me, Mike Torres," she said, brushing her cheek against his. "I'm gonna be cleaning up whiskey and blood and glass as soon as you leave." "Girl," he said, "girl." He pushed away from her, hurried out the door, and drove away. Shelley had heard the name Gandhi before, but didn't really know who he was. If he was high-fiving Jesus, he must have been somebody important, though. It looked like he was wearing a diaper in that tattoo. She didn't know a hell of a lot about Jesus either, except for Christmas and Easter. She was a little murky on what happened in between. At least Mike Torres had his heroes. Why couldn't he have been hers? Now he was back in his sweet-smelling car, driving away into the thick darkness that had taken her father and brother. She wanted it to take her too. She wanted to buy a ticket on darkness and let it take her on a long ride, but she had no currency recognized by night. She had a candy necklace. Her shoe crunched against broken glass. The bright overhead light created garish sparkles off of the ruins. How could Tina just walk right past it? How could she get the phone message from the ER and not care? Shelley felt like she was exploding out of her skin. The two bedrooms were full, and the living room was a crime scene. She had nowhere to go in that tiny house that wasn't tainted. She went into the bathroom and locked the door. She removed her tight shirt and her flimsy bra and stared at herself in the mirror above the sink. She applied more mascara and eyeliner until her eyes were black holes. She rouged her cheeks bright red, but she was still Shelley. She removed her jeans and underwear. Tina was pounding on the door now, and she heard her mother's muffled voice demanding something. She turned on the water to drown out their voices. She pulled the hospital papers out of her purse and folded them into paper airplanes the way her father had taught her once when he was home and she was a child. She creased each document hard against the bathroom tile, then cranked open the window. She lit each piece of paper with her lighter and sent them sailing out into the night to see how far they could travel before turning to ash. So that's that story. Thank you. And we're just going to have a short transition to show this film that, as John said, is adapted from a short story. So if afterwards you want to talk about that process of turning a story into a film, I'll be happy to do that. And we had a very limited budget for this film, so we did the best we could.
Rapids in Big Rapids, no mountains in Mount Pleasant. When I was a child, I misread the map and thought the town was Mr. Pleasant. I was sorely disappointed when I discovered the truth. Still, I ended up at Central. Maybe I was hoping I'd find a Mr. Pleasant who cut me some slack. It was the only school that accepted me. I needed to get away from Detroit and the factory life. And if it took college to get me there, so be it. I'm majoring in bowling. My QPA in bowling is 177.
Hey, come on, man, we're leaving.
Stay.
Yeah, Red, we're going.
Hey, have you met my friends, the Glumbergs?
Yeah, actually, it's Rumberg, so Matt Rumberg. I'm getting my master's at Central.
Robin, I'm a friend of Sam's.
Oh, actually, we're friends of Sam's from Mount Pleasant.
Mountains Only Ones?
Yeah. Come on. We lift weights together.
He lifts more.
Red. I'm not coming back for you.
I know. I'll hit you something. Look at her hair. She's my long-lost sister. We're just destined to have an incestuous relationship.
He's just looking out for me. We're second cousins, step cousins, something like that.
Bastard cousins. Come on, Red can screw this up all by himself.
I'm staying. Have me some more chili.
What about Bruce?
My dog.
More like our dog. You couldn't even pass Pet Care 101.
Hey, find me a course like that, I'll sign up. Absolutely aced bowling. They can't bowl for shit up here in the middle of the mitten. She's still pissed about Bruce chewing up Joni Mitchell.
I love Mexican. Don't ice this.
Long story.
Why is everything a long story? Whatever happened to the good old short stories?
Red means the nice little picture books.
No, I mean short stories. Give you a little glance of something. Leave you wanting more.
Detroit.
You just don't like conclusions. That's where you always fuck up.
This is the short story. The slice of life. You eat one piece, you want more. You eat the rest, you get all bloated and shit.
I thought you were majoring in bowling.
Majoring in bowling. Minoring in the literature of the hip. I graduate with a bowling ball and a beret.
Literature of the hips. Last night in Dallas, and you are no help. Red needs a moral compass, and all you give him is a box of rubbers.
Gravel. Gravel. Great gravel.
Yeah, well, all for the promise of a good party, right?
Gravel. Gravel. Party. Party. We're gonna party. Party.
Yeah, all right. If we can stay off the gravel.
Oh, I don't know about the snow, but... we're gonna party, party.
You're just egging on Party Boy here. Living vicariously.
Vicariously?
It means when you get laid, Matt gets laid a bit too.
That's pretty cool when you think about it. Just a family thing.
You're what, third cousins, thrice removed?
Blood is blood. Right, Matt?
That blood's pretty thin. Are we going to talk about last night?
Hey, I pay my rent. I can have overnight guests.
Okay.
Your friend.
Wait a second. Thrice? That's the first time I've ever heard you say the word thrice.
So I was getting you with those fancy words. I got my own fancy word. P-A-R...
That's enough. Can we turn around now?
Oh, come on. I mean, we haven't seen Sam since he graduated. I mean, don't you miss old Sam?
Sam tried to hit on me last year.
Whoa, he did?
You two gonna have a fight? You want me to drive?
Let's play hangman. I'll start. A blank blank H blank blank blank.
Why'd you give us two letters?
I don't want you getting it wrong.
I got it. Am I high?
That's awesome.
Nice party, Robin. Who's this clown?
What's the biggest lie you ever told?
That I'm Jesus Christ.
That's my biggest lie, too.
We have so much in common.
Two redhead messiah complexes.
It's a miracle.
Hey, Sam. Be right back.
Thank you.
Look outside. Mr. Golden Sun. Where you been, partner? Maybe we should lay down and close our eyes and...
We are not having sex again.
The sky is the kind of blue that almost makes you happy to be sad. The kind of blue that only shows up in dreams and commercials for swimming pools. The kind of blue that makes you think you could take care of a dog. Or fall in love. Or get your toilet bowl clean. Remember those old TV commercials with monkeys dressed in clothes singing, red rose tea, red rose tea, red rose tea.
No, no, I don't. I don't. Excuse me. Even remember your name.
Red? Tim, actually, though.
And I am?
Robin. Never got your last name. You're a teacher. You should be good at names. My teachers always remember me.
I bet they do. But you don't sleep with them, do you? It does something to the memory, like, what the hell was I thinking? See, right now, I wish I could remember that. Okay, Tim. Great sleeping with you last night, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how are you getting back to Mount Pleasant? I don't have a car. Had an accident. Long story.
If everything in your life's a long story, do you ever tell them to anyone?
Don't go getting personal on me now. I don't give my confessions to choir boys.
Last night you weren't so concerned how I'd get home. I can hitch.
Sunday morning on 46? I'll call Sam.
You happen to have any coffee?
I quit caffeine. I'll do anything to get to sleep. I watched you sleep last night.
I'll call Sam. He'll take me back. Where'd he be on a Sunday morning in Big Rapids? Not church.
Someone else's bed. Where do you think? You know anyone else in this great metropolis to call?
I slept with someone else yesterday morning before we left Mount P. A girl I'd picked up at a bar. Friend of Jennifer's. Rumberg. She'd been appalled. Well, we'd all been appalled. Coming here seemed like a great idea. Taking my little act on the road. You know the feeling. What you're feeling now. Felt it all day yesterday. I know this sounds fucked up, but I thought sleeping with you. It doesn't even make sense to me anymore.
Fair enough. The truth is fair enough.
fucked up, as you say.
I'll walk home.
Oh, I bet you would if you could. Or tap dance into oblivion.
Hey, what'd be worse? Walking home to Mr. Pleasant or tap dancing into oblivion?
You said Mr. Pleasant.
No, I didn't. Mr. Pleasant is just a mirage. A location on a lost pirate map they accidentally buried with the treasure.
You're like a mirage that turned into a sandstorm. Or a snowstorm. Mary Jean? Yeah. I'm in a situation here. Yeah. Could you drive me in this? Sorry. Could you drive me in the sky over to Mount Pleasant this morning? Yes. A new friend. His friends left him. Friends from Mount Pleasant. Sam's. He's not home. I don't know. I'll pay for gas. I'll buy you lunch. Just help me out. Please.
Trying to turn me into this big loser. You don't know me.
And you knew that girl from yesterday? She's gay, so.
So.
Just watch your mouth.
Hey, I'm not gonna look a gift lesbian in the mouth.
Jerk. Watch your boots back there.
Mount P.
The Art of Destiny.
Where do you get music like that out here?
Mars. Or perhaps Chicago. When the winds blow right, you can pick up a lot of things. So, how did Blue Jeans Day go at the Mount last week?
Everybody was supposed to wear jeans if they support gay rights, but everyone always wears jeans. It's like cheating or something. So, it was a big hit. Everyone wore jeans, as usual.
It's not cheating. It forces you to go out of your way to say that you don't support gay rights. That's how it should be. Everybody wears jeans every day, and everybody deals with gay people every day, even if they don't realize it. The point is that it's as ordinary as wearing jeans.
No, it's like stuff in the ballot box. Look, right now, we're all wearing jeans.
Everybody spends so much time trying to slap on labels. We just be our own fucked up selves.
Didn't they have a Blue Jean Day at Ferris?
You're getting Big Rapids mixed up with Grand Rapids. Everybody in Big Rapids is in the closet except for me and the two dykes that run a dry cleaners.
Is that the name of it? Two Dykes Dry Cleaners?
Oh, I like that. I really like that. The problem is three's still a crowd.
Sometimes one's a crowd. Can't you turn up the heat?
Hey, you want a sip of coffee? It must be cold back there.
There's nobody in a closet in Detroit. That's where we hide the dead bodies.
What about Rod and Jack up the landing?
You just thought of them because you have a crush on Jack. Since her accident, I've been driving her down to the IGA for groceries. People are beginning to talk, I hope.
There's talk, and then there's talk. Sometimes you can talk yourself into tap dancing into oblivion.
Here's the weekend weather update. After yesterday's blizzard, we've got a clear sunny day out there. Don't put those snow shovels away just yet. There's another 4 to 6 inches coming on Monday.
This isn't the snow belt. It's the no belt. Not anything that isn't considered normal. They got a pretty narrow slice of pie, what they call normal up here. Even in Grand Rapids. Big, grand. They're all just lies. Small people. They called me horse in high school.
You look pretty normal. I mean, you...
So what are you majoring in college, dude?
Bowling. He's majoring in bowling.
She can't remember my name, but she remembers that. Undeclared. I'm undeclared. Weighing options. They're all over the weight limit.
I thought you lifted weights.
I lift dumbbells. Not the same.
Is getting out of bed in the morning count as part of your workout?
What year are you? Shouldn't you be declared by now?
I've deferred declaring.
That could be a problem later on. It sounds like you declared deferring.
It's a problem now. think I may have thrown my last strike at Central. In Detroit, we have these things called factories. And they sing the siren song, and we all go crashing into the rocks. I just wanted to be far enough away so I couldn't hear them. Wouldn't it be great if you could just push buttons and change the sky?
Now you're sleeping with guys who wear tinfoil hats. Looks like Ohio out there. Ohio is a state of mind. Just look out there. To get the full depressing effect. You're just a riot today. I'm so glad I chose to spend my Sunday in your presence. Where are we going to lunch? The Embers?
The Embers, favorite spot for frat boys and sorority girls before the semi-formal.
Home of the bloody steak.
It kicked me out after I puked on my sport coat.
The Embers. She must have been hot.
Yeah. And I impressed the hell out of her, too.
Big boys. You're taking me to big boys, and I'm getting strawberry pie.
Knock yourself out.
Does Big Boy have a penis?
Yeah, but it's a little one.
Big Boy and his girlfriend, Dolly. Who comes up with this stuff?
If you ever see me wearing red checkered overalls, just shoot me.
Yeah. You're a blue jean wearing, gay rights supporting kind of guy. This guy's talking penis size here. What's your assessment vis-a-vis last night?
Vis-a-vis?
It's a gay term.
If I ever get that excited about bingo, just shoot me.
Why are you so interested in getting shot? Bingo's harmless enough. Worst things to be addicted to.
Like?
Drugs. Alcohol.
Drugs and alcohol. Accessories for a good time. Most of the time.
Sex.
What?
Yeah. How long does it last? Good buzz lasts longer. As long as you're not driving, it's a lot safer. Look at us right now. We're driving halfway across the fucking state.
I'm driving halfway across the fucking state. You were just admiring the scenery.
Bingo.
Was it worth it?
I learned something last night and today. Just haven't figured it out yet. Mary Jean, you know who you are. That's something. Maybe I should transfer Northern or Eastern or Western U. Maybe I'm just not cut out to be Central.
I think it's the U part causing the trouble.
I think you might be right, but dropping out, it's not how it's supposed to end. Why don't we have a Southern Michigan University? That'd put us in Ohio.
Ohio.
I think she likes me. It's just our hangover talking. We got the red hair thing going and everything.
It's a dye job.
Oh, we're making good time. Woody has to drag a foot out the door to find the road.
You dragged your foot across the state just to go to her party? She didn't even invite me. Clowns from Central, sure, but not the one person she can count on.
Clowns from Central.
You're just a punk from Detroit. Why'd she sleep with you when she won't sleep with me?
Because she's not gay? I mean, she's not, right?
The clock doesn't work. Used to. Mr. Pleasant. We French kissed once. It was an accident.
A long story?
Short. Kind you like. Depends on who's telling it.
It always does. So, here's where old Red gets his shit together and gets all A's, goes on to a rewarding job helping the less fortunate, escaping the working class world of his youth, right? Nah. Old Red packs up and moves back home. I drive by Mount Pleasant once a week on my delivery run up to Mackinac, bringing hoagie buns to all the good people of the Mitten. Sometimes I stop and see the Rumbergs, Matt and Jennifer, who aren't nearly as glum as I had thought back then. They're happy to see me, bearing hoagie buns and hugs for all. They kept my dog, Bruce. Speaking of dogs, we've all heard about the dog running home with his tail between his legs like that's something bad. But now I think, well, at least the dog still got the damn thing.
Red Rose, Red Rose.
We made that movie just so we could use the Red Rose Tea song at the end. But we couldn't use the dancing monkeys, which would have been great. So I thought I'd open it up to see if anybody had any questions about either the story or the film or anything in between. Yeah.
So I noticed at the end credit is given to some county in Ohio. Was it actually Ohio?
Yes, yes. We didn't have enough money to come to Michigan. Pittsburgh, where I'm at, is too hilly to look like central Michigan. So we drove to Ohio, and we found a small town, and we had this guy make a very nice, we thought, Mount Pleasant sign. We stuck it in the snow, and the local police said, whatever. And so it's Mount Pleasant for a few minutes. So yeah, we were kind of resourceful like that. I wish we could have come back here, but hopefully that stood in for that flat mid-Michigan landscape, particularly this time of year, maybe tomorrow. Other questions about anything? Okay, well, I'll be around signing books or just to talk if you want to linger. Oh, yes.
Nora. Talk about the process of physically making that into a film. I mean, your way of envisioning that is a film.
Okay, so my partner in these last films, Dumpster, which we showed here a number of years ago when that came out, and Mr. Pleasant, were both directed by John Rice, who, like most of the people in Pittsburgh film, got to start working on George Romero's zombie films. So mm-hmm. His first movie was Dawn of the Dead that he worked on. But John likes the challenge of, we're not really interested in making cheap versions of what might be a Hollywood film. We're trying to do something different within the limitations of what we're working with. And a lot of what I've always tried to do as a writer, sometimes more successfully than others, is to try and find poems and stories in the small everyday things that you might not think a story would be there. And I try and kind of do the same thing in the movies. And so Dumpster, which those of you who saw it remember, a lot of it took place inside a dumpster. And it was John's idea to make this particular story into a film because he liked the challenge of trying to do so much inside of a car, because that's such a static thing. It's almost something you want to avoid as a filmmaker, to try and make a car ride interesting. But he liked the triangular thing versus the bench seat across. And so that was sort of one of the things that drew him to the story. And the first film that I did, No Pets, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So I took the short story, No Pets, and took out everything that wasn't dialogue, and then I tried to build it back up. And so when I look at that now, what works best is the stuff that was originally in the story. So now I try to have a stronger sense of, one of the things it's taught me as a writer is the difficulty of using dialogue in a story versus using dialogue in real time in a film. So John and I went back and forth with the script for a long, long time. So basically we worked on the script and getting all the people in place and finding locations and casting for a year. We filmed it in 5 days over spring break, and then we spent another year editing it. So it's a year on each side and then 5 days shooting. And a lot of the music is by former students of mine who have had bands at one time in their life and were willing to give music. We wanted to have one period piece that would set it in the late 70s, early 80s, but we couldn't afford even that. So we tried to find music that wasn't, it didn't seem like it came after that, at least. And I don't know if you noticed, but we snuck in a few little notes that might maybe like sound like the beginning of a Bob Seger song. And sue us, Bob, go ahead. just as a transitional thing. And so what I like about doing projects like the film is the collaborative aspect. Because those of you who are in the room who are writers, you know, it's mostly just sitting in a room by yourself. And when you're working with film, you're working with all these other creative people that bring their energy to it. And so one of another thing that I've learned, particularly in the editing, because I have about 10 different CDs that have different, or DVDs that have different versions of this, because I'd sit in the editing room with the director and the film editor, another George Romero zombie film alum named Tom Dubinsky, and we'd just talk and make suggestions, and then he'd burn a DVD for all of us, and we'd go back. And one of the things, as a writer, see, one of the things I'm proud of in this film is the 2 minutes where nobody says anything. You know, when they're juxtaposing the drive home with the morning after. And because that was one of the things I've had to learn is to trust the visuals and to trust the actor's expressions. So we're sitting there, and you get a look from the actor, and you say, oh, that look allows us to cut these three lines of dialogue. And so that's been really useful for me as a learning process. I'm still learning, but it's a real challenge. But I like working with John, working with local actors, and he made his living making like TV commercials and industrial videos for many years and picking up whatever film work he can. So he teaches filmmaking at Point Park University in Pittsburgh now, but he has all these contacts in the local film community that it's one of those things like writers or anything else where everybody knows each other. So it was enough years. We made Dumpster in 2005, so there were enough years had passed so that he could begin calling in all his favors again. So we get like the discounted rate on various things so that we can make a film for this was like maybe $12,000. So I got a faculty development grant from Carnegie Mellon, so they were thanked at the end for $9,000, and I think John got $3,000 from Point Park University to, again, some kind of faculty development grant, and we cobbled it together and made it work. And then, our market for a 38-minute film is obviously, film festivals, because it's just this weird length, and so we realized it. And so the last movie was 64 minutes. And so John and I are thinking we should at least think a little bit about length, because even in the film festival world, those lengths are problematic in terms of what categories they fit into. It's like a short long or a long feature, or, so. But the sad thing is, but also kind of interesting, is that I'm pretty sure, even with the limited distribution of these films, that more people have seen these films than have read any of my books. So the idea of trying to reach another audience with some of the things that I'm interested in exploring and talking about is exciting, and I hope maybe at some point some of those people who maybe see the movie might pick up one of the books or something. yeah.
Could you string together a couple of your short stories to make maybe a 90-minute film? And then maybe take an extra
couple of years to do it. We have actually talked about that, and maybe that'll be the next thing that we do. These things are incredibly exhausting to make, particularly as I get older, and he's like 1 year older than me, so we're definitely coming from the same place. There's this kind of exhaustion after we finish one, but we work together really well, and it helps that we work so much together on the scripts, so that by the time the clock is ticking, we're on a set, we know exactly what we're looking for. So, because I know my role, I'm not the director. I'm on the set all the time, but I'm doing things like making sure people get fed and they're in costume or have shown up. But on a script, John will sit and say, okay, now why is this character saying this here? What are they thinking? And so I give him all these notes and answer his questions so that on the set and working with the cast, he knows at least kind of what we're aiming for. But we have been talking about, yeah, why don't we put a couple things together, and maybe if we can scrounge up some more money down the line, we might do that. We even talked about trying to connect Dumpster and Mr. Pleasant somehow, because they do overlap in that. In, I guess in both of the films, the main characters are not the most sympathetic character all the time, and that's another thing that I'm interested in terms of exploring, apart from a kind of traditional mainstream film. And I guess if that little voiceover at the end, maybe it's a little heavy-handed, but I think there's a certain kind of film that explores the working class that's kind of formulaic in this happy ending of escape, and that's the only salvation. And so I really wanted to play against that, because I know, you know, people in the Detroit area where I'm from who didn't go to college or dropped out of college, and you know, they're happy and living productive lives, and you know, and they made their choices, and that I think that condescending view of, you know, getting out is sometimes oversimplified in a stereotypical kind of way. So I wanted to put in a little dig there. Oh yeah.
So when you're writing something now, are you thinking about what this would look like as a film? I mean, when you started writing, you probably were thinking was Mr. Pleasant, for instance. Do you roll Mr. Pleasant or Dumpster or whatever? Were you thinking, wonder what this would look like as a film?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it does come up, and I am more aware of it. And even with Trigger Man, there are certain stories in there that I think, oh, you know, that one might be an interesting one to do. I don't think about it as much in the process, but I think it's become part of my writing process. And I think it's helped me be more conscious of how I'm using dialogue in particular, and because there is a difference in dialogue between reading it on the page and having somebody read it or speak it in real life on a film, not beyond what you see in the background and what the actor's expressions are. There is this time where when you're reading dialogue on the page, you read it quicker than if you're reading it out loud. And so a kind of awareness of that in terms of how people are earning their speeches on the page, I think it's affected my writing that way, too. I saw, yeah?
I might be mistaken, but one time during the drive, I thought the car was going down the wrong side of the road. Am I missing something?
Well, it pulls in front of the house on the wrong side of the road.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about driving down the road. You got the impression the car was on the west side of the road.
I'd have to look at it again. But if you saw it, I'm sure you did.
In other words, there's some message there?
I don't think so. I mean, in Dumpster, in the script, the whole thing was that this guy shoveled snow at the school, and when it snowed, it meant more overtime for him. So it was supposed to have all the snow, and it didn't snow at all. So we had to change the whole script so that he's not getting the overtime because it's not snowing. And in this film, we had 2 feet of snow. So the day we were going to drive out to Ohio, my car got stuck in John Rice's driveway. I mean, so we had too much snow. And so maybe we were so stressed out, we ended up on the wrong side of the road. It wouldn't surprise me because we were just sort of, it's kind of guerrilla filmmaking. So there was one house where nobody, looked like nobody was home. So we set up the camera. We could see our boot prints in the snow, trudging through these 2 feet of snow so that we could set up the camera there and have the car drive back and forth. And then we had to kind of hope that no car that was newer drove by. And some cars did, if you look closely. And we had to find old cars. And then my father had his Michigan Bicentennial license plates. So we got those. And that big old bomber with the, because we wanted it, John said, we need to have a car with a bench seat. And one of my former students had sold that car to a guy who was a cemetery sort of watchman. He lived in a little house in a cemetery. So I call him up. This guy I don't even know. I said, can I use your car for this movie for a couple days? He said, well, I need a car. So if you give me your car, you can take that car. So this guy didn't even know. I gave him the keys to my car for 3 days, and I had this whole bomber. And but, you know, those are the chances he had to take. And then the Volvo broke down on the way to Ohio. What happened was the defogger stopped working, and he had to turn around and drive home. So we did run into some problems there. And actually, I want to mention the trickiest part because it almost brought the whole film down. And that's, I don't know how realistic it looked when they were driving, but we filmed the stuff in the car in a sound studio in Pittsburgh with a giant green screen. And we edited the whole film with the green screen out the car windows, and then this guy was supposed to put in the snow and the stuff that we'd shot out in Ohio in the windows, and it looked so fake the first time he did it. And we said, oh, it's going to ruin the whole movie, because in the old movies, when they're driving, you know it's fake, you know, whatever's out the window, but people expect it to look realistic, and it immediately pulled you out of the movie because it looked so fake. And so we had to bring in another special effects guy and just blow extra money on him to solve that. Because we couldn't actually film while we were driving in the snow, but we had to film the car, you know, moving in the snow and stuff. Anyway, it was. I'll watch it again and see what side of the road we're on. Yeah.
So what's the process for shopping it around to film festivals? Is it submit it? Is it like a jury thing? Or
Yeah, there's a website. There's a website for everything, but there's a site called Without a Box that is sort of the conduit to enter just about every film festival in the country, which is nice because you can make an online press kit and things like that and put the trailer up. And typically they're juried, and sometimes you get feedback. Sometimes they just say yes or no. But you know, I think we're at about a dozen with this film, which you know we're pretty happy with. And I was more strategic in which ones we entered because I wanted to actually go to more of them. Because last time, like, we got in a film festival in South Africa and Wales and stuff. We thought that was cool, but we couldn't go. So what was the point? because it's fun. I mean, film festivals are fun in terms of meeting other filmmakers and seeing stuff that's outside the mainstream. Maybe one more question, if there are any, because I know people have other things to do and stuff like that. Okay, well, thanks again for coming, and I'll be here for a while and talk. We appreciate it.